I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Growing our communities in ways that are economically and environmentally smart is today's imperative, and today's guest advised communities on the latest strategies for achieving that goal. Lee Einsweiler is principal with Code Studio in Austin. He is working with municipalities around the country to develop new land use codes that support their evolution over time and a more harmonious way of life. Paul Polizotto is founder and CEO of EcoMedia, where he is bringing companies and cities together to support new environmental projects. We'll talk about smarter ways for cities to grow today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Lee Einsweiler is principal with Code Studio in Austin. Lee has been responsible for more than 40 code projects across the country. He's currently working in Denver, Memphis, and Shelby County, Sun Valley, Idaho, and suburban communities outside Charlotte and San Antonio. In Savannah, Georgia, Lee is helping protect fragile historic resources and special environments with the Metropolitan Planning Commission there. Lee, from a land planning point of view, what makes a community work?
Well, I think that we're finding that we know a whole lot about what makes a community not work, and maybe not so much about what really makes it work. Things that make it not work include homogeneous patterns of single uses, whether it's large areas of commercial with no residential or large areas of residential with no commercial. That's probably our single biggest problem. So mixing it up is what we know about what makes it work.
And what is it about homogeneous single uses that doesn't work?
It's the deadly auto trip. It's the fact that really one can no longer be involved in daily life, whether with a family or with a spouse, without significant trips all the time to all of your daily needs. The trip to work, the trip to get the gallon of milk, all of those become an automobile trip when we don't do an effective job of mixing uses.
When you go into a community and evaluate a community, what do you look for to say this community's working or this community's not working?
Well, in fact, we have a very narrow focus, which is just on how they regulate development. And our principal question for them is, based on the plans that they've already prepared, are they successfully implementing those plans and those visions? And you will hardly find a community in the U.S. anymore that doesn't say they want to be walkable, sustainable, et cetera. And yet, when you look at the codes that implement those plans, you'll find significant gaps in their ability to make the kinds of things happen that the city would actually like to make happen.
Why is that? We've inherited old codes that were built on the principles for another time. What is inherent in those codes that makes them not work?
That's definitely a significant part of the equation. During the 60s and 70s, we really suburbanized every city in the country, it seemed like. A good example would be Memphis, in which the existing pattern of lots has lots as small as about 3,500 square feet throughout the entire older portion of the community. That 3,500 square foot lot is substantially below the required lot of the zoning district, which is 6,000 square feet. So over 13,000 lots in the city are, in essence, unbuildable according to the zoning of today in Memphis. It comes from a time when we thought we were going to take down two houses and put up one brand spanking new one. I think we've gotten beyond that time, and so we're beginning to see a trend away from that, a trend toward acceptance of smaller lot sizes, acceptance of greater mixes of commercial and residential. But it really comes from that time when we thought everything would be a tower in a park or a beautiful green suburb.
Talk to me about planning history a minute. What was it that was driving that sort of thinking? It obviously was not there from the turn of the century. Something changed in the 50s?
Yes, I think that's what most people point to is the post-war boom, which gave us the ticky-tacky houses on the hillside and gave us Levittown and other sort of amazing excesses of production building. Was the start, but really, it is a whole American philosophy about what the good life really is. If you were to ask a Frenchman about what the good life is, you would get a very different answer than you would get from the typical American. We have somehow embedded in almost everyone's brain the sense that when you have grown up to a certain point, you must have a large lot in the suburbs to raise your family. And yet we're seeing some I think, hopeful trends in response to that. Vancouver reports that a second high-rise building in their downtown is going to have an elementary school in it and that they're finding they can successfully attract families back into the downtown core simply by providing the kinds of services that families are interested in. So we're working away from that old model, but that change of our whole philosophy happens very, very slowly.
You haven't used the term yet, but in many ways what you're describing is something that is commonly called smart growth.
Yes.
It's a frequent topic on our show. In fact, we talked about it with Anthony Flint last week and his new book. But understanding the concept of smart growth and actually achieving smart growth, as you said earlier, are two very different things. What are the latest breakthroughs on getting to the kinds of neighborhoods you're saying make communities work?
Well, I think in my narrow portion of the profession, which is really all about the codes that implement plans, in my portion of the profession, the one breakthrough would be what the new urban community is doing in regard to form-based codes. The change from thinking about a code which is primarily focused on regulating uses and separating uses one from the other to a code that is much more focused on how the public realm, meaning the space between two buildings, from the building front through the sidewalk, across the street, across the adjacent sidewalk, and to the front of the adjacent building, how that public space operates, which is really the place that we should be regulating, the place that we should be comfortable imposing the common will in regard to how activity happens. And getting those spaces right is much, much more important than anything that we might do about use. If you stop and think about a great historic building, I'm sitting in a recording studio now in Austin, Texas, that was once a warehouse. It's a stunning reuse, and we certainly didn't envision it when we built the warehouse in the first place. So stopping to regulate use in these fine slices and dices of butcher, baker, candlestick maker is where we've really gotten caught up in current zoning. And I think this trend toward form-based codes is a move away from that and probably a refreshing change.
Give me a practical application of a form-based code. How does it play out in reality?
The greatest successes with form-based codes are in two very, very different settings. One is greenfields development, new construction of wholly new communities. And this would be the traditional neighborhood development and other sort of master planned large-scale developments in which the code is put in place before any uses or anything else even go on the ground. It's done as part of a design process, and the code is very strongly linked to the actual design. The other situation, though, which is much more intriguing, I think, is the current trend toward using form-based codes in trying to help restore either downtowns, urban corridors, other areas where significant deterioration of the urban fabric has occurred, where all the teeth have fallen out of the smile. We've pushed the buildings back from the street. We've put parking lots out front. We've over-widened the adjacent roadways. And so in trying to bring life back to those corridors and bring back what was once that strong mixed-use presence that occurred in many of them is a great example of where form-based codes are being used.
And can you give me a specific example of where you think the teeth have been put back in or the roadways have been narrowed to make a better urban environment?
Well, in fact, it's happening fairly slowly. There are some examples that are often pointed to, Columbia Pike being one of the most common examples. It's in Arlington, Virginia. It extends from basically the Pentagon out, and Arlington Pike was a classic suburban corridor, strip shopping centers, small office buildings, small apartment buildings. Really no activity for a significant period of time, and the Form Based Code went in place several years ago, and immediately the development market responded and has proposed substantial number of new buildings that are on the drawing boards and through the approval process. So we're going to see some activity there soon. There are other great examples most everywhere where significant new urban activity has taken place. For example, work done by Andras Dwani or Victor Dover. You would see downtowns and other areas that are thriving on the basis of sort of having lifted off this use restriction cap that we are typically involved in, and setting up an envelope for construction that makes much more sense to the private marketplace. And so the private marketplace is responding in places like the city of Fort Myers, the city of Sarasota, and other places where downtown plans have been done. Petaluma would be another example.
Why does it make more sense to the development market?
Well, in fact, the developers have a favorite word. I consider it the developer's F word, and that's flexibility. And every time a city considers rules, the development community is concerned about what the implications of those rules are for the kinds of products that they would normally build. And when the rules don't match market reality, you won't get developer investment. And unfortunately, many folks in the planning community, and in fact many involved in the development business other than the developers themselves, are somewhat insensitive to market economics and don't really know how to set a code to the point that it actually begins to make sense for the private marketplace to step in and make the vision of the community happen. If the vision is too off of what the marketplace will actually provide, instead you get no activity, and I think that's to no one's benefit in most cities.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest barriers, Lee, to using form-based codes and other methods to encourage, again, what you call a community that works?
I think one of the biggest barriers, the true form-based code relies on an underlying illustrative master plan, meaning a drawn plan of all the buildings, all the activity that will be occurring in that area. And the development of that level of detailed planning is an expensive process.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly the cost of that is a significant barrier. Now, stepping back from that, there are more hybrid models of the notion of form-based code that don't require quite so much detailed activity and might be available to smaller communities with less money and other places. But it's that thinking about the form that's hard. The other thing that's really, really difficult is typically we have dealt with streets separately from the way that we have dealt with land. And one of the few really good examples of bringing those two together that I know of is the so-called Blueprint Denver, Denver's Land Use and Transportation Plan, in which the streets are treated in the same plan document as the buildings and the land itself. Without that kind of a setup in which we're thinking about both at the same time, then this idea of dealing with successfully with the public realm and building better places for people will be fairly ineffective, because zoning stays on the private side and we see streets and the public elements as being on the city's side. And if the city is not stepping in with a proactive capital improvements plan to make those modifications to streets, whether it's narrowing or, as advocates of reducing free parking suggest, providing meters or other kinds of things, streetscape elements like trees in the streets, which are so, so important to the future walkability and livability of cities. So without stepping in and dealing with those questions, we're kind of stuck in our traditional mode of zoning over here, subdivision and capital improvements and streets over here.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Lee Einsweiler. He is principal with Code Studio. The average citizen, Lee, isn't interested, doesn't understand zoning codes or form-based codes, but the average citizen isn't terribly satisfied with what the current codes are producing. So how do you make the link between the two and get citizens activated on these technical issues? Or is it actually a sale that you have to make to the technicians, to the planners?
I think it has to happen on both levels. In fact, it's very easy to get the public involved because the public knows what they like. And so given a picture or a description of a place that they know and love, they can tell you exactly what they want and what the important elements are. The trouble is then when we talk to the technical portion, we have competing obligations. We're doing some work in Peoria, Illinois as an example. It's the home of Caterpillar. And Caterpillar has a desire to be able to change their shifts rapidly. And that desire means that a lot of people have to flow in and out of their downtown facility. And that means that typically if we're responding to just that concern, we build a very big pipe for people to flow in and out of, meaning the street adjacent to their development. In fact, that may be the wrong problem to solve. We may actually want to suggest that Caterpillar is better as a provider of employees who actually want to live, shop, work, etc. in the area. In that case, the problem that we're solving is not how to move them in and out on the biggest, most efficient pipe, but in fact how to build a pipe that serves multiple functions. And that would include building a street which is much more walkable, much more enjoyable as a pedestrian environment.
You've begun using realistic photo-like pictures of what communities can look like if their plans are executed. You found that there's real power in pictures?
Absolutely. There's simply no doubt that the general public cannot visualize. Mm-hmm. There are two trends out there, both of which are very important. We now have the ability to model in 3D in ways that we never have and give people a walkthrough of an environment before it is ever built, a very, very powerful tool. And then the photo simulation tool, the ability to drop new buildings or new elements like street trees. It is amazing to watch the simple modification of a street through the addition of street trees and pavement markings and crosswalks. The addition of those walkable elements is just something that people instantly react to. It certainly makes you wonder why we aren't, as cities, focused much more on trying to get back those amenities that we once believed so much in.
Where does sign regulation fit into your into the work that you do?
Sign regulation is a very, very tough issue. There are lots of First Amendment issues involved in signs. There's an immense amount of sign litigation going on all around the country right now. Really, signs are one of those elements that is best left to the experts, and many of the experts now have to be lawyers because it's become a very, very tough business to be in. But the fact of the matter is that if you treat everyone equally, provide them all the same sign area and the same availability for their message, you can probably successfully have signs. Then the question becomes what scale, what size do we believe people ought to be able to have? And then the second question of whether we ought to have off-premises signs, meaning billboards. Those are really tough issues that cities across the country are definitely wrangling with. It's become very difficult to modify the regulations in regard to signs. For example, in Texas, we can no longer amortize or eliminate a sign over a period of years without cost to the city. In fact, the city, if they want to eliminate a sign that they think is overly large or otherwise does not meet their current regulations, there's an obligation in Texas now to buy that sign to eliminate it. That being the case, we have a lot of trouble changing the regulations significantly because a new owner then feels like they have, for example, a teeny tiny monument sign in comparison to their adjacent neighbor who has a very large pole sign. Especially in a suburban environment where we've got lots of traffic moving fairly swiftly, that becomes a difficult concern. The nice thing is that the movement toward more walkable streets means that in many instances we're talking about a reduced need for that large-scale signage that is normally a concern to people because instead we're moving at slower speeds and therefore can read smaller letters and we're focused again on the pedestrian, in which case a different type of sign, a projecting sign and other kinds kinds of more elegant sign types is much more important than the large-scale, you know, blaring pole sign that we use to attract people off of the freeway to our development.
You've worked in cities all over the country. You've worked with citizens all over the country. Is better land use planning a Democrat issue, a Republican issue, or can both parties and people of all persuasions embrace this idea?
I believe that it crosses over. There's very little doubt in my mind. In fact, the patterns we have been constructing are inefficient. And so if one is simply looking at the cost to a city of the provision of infrastructure and other required services, those patterns as inefficient patterns are simply wrong from a cost perspective. They are bumping our taxes up. They are making us all pay more than we would like to be paying for a number of things. They're also demanding, you know, too much energy, personally and from an electric and gas and all the other perspectives. So if one were simply a fiscal conservative, one would be looking for this change in patterns simply because of the cost issues associated with them. If one were more on the socially liberal end of the spectrum, then one would be talking about the issues of bowling alone and other kinds of social issues associated with the more isolationist patterns of development that we've been creating. So I think that both ends of the spectrum do find a good place to be on in terms of these issues. The principal point being that there's not just one pattern that's right for everybody, and we often get stuck in that. I think it's one of the problems that we've been having along the Mississippi and Louisiana coast, for example, in the post-Katrina environment, is the notion that from the outside we should be imposing a pattern on any of those communities. In fact, there is a right pattern for every community, and each one might well be different. But it's going in and talking to people about how to balance those objectives, helping them understand both the finance and economic issues, the planning issues, the design issues, the social issues that surround all of this. That's very important. Codes are part of a system that we use to regulate land, and the extent to which we should be regulating should be a constant question. We should always be asking ourselves, do we need this rule? There are many times when, yes, a rule is very important because the market is simply not responding the way that the community desires, because the market is operating in the short term and the community may well have a longer term view.
Lee, I appreciate you being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks.
Lee Einsweiler is principal with Code Studio in Austin. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Paul Polizotto about ecozones, and Otis White will tell us why the student population of San Francisco public schools is shrinking. Smart City is made possible in part by the support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Regional Chamber, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, you reported on a recent series in the San Francisco Chronicle on why San Francisco schools were losing student population. What did they find?
Well, it's a bit of a mystery, Carol. The schools in San Francisco aren't really bad schools, particularly as urban school systems go. They're significantly above average. In California, they are actually above average for state schools systems anywhere in the state. So a little bit of a mystery, but clearly there is something lacking there, because since 2000, the district has lost about 8% of its student population, and it's closed 9 schools and 2 preschools. So this is the question that the San Francisco Chronicle was asking. So what explains it? Is it a lack of money? No, it seems the school system is pretty well funded. Are there some really bad individual schools? Well, of course, but there increasingly are parents getting involved in some of these schools, and they're really improving things. So objectively, there is no reason for this loss of students, at least as far as the school system itself is concerned. But the big problem seems to be things outside the school system, and that is connected with the greatest problem probably in San Francisco today, which is the incredible cost of housing there. And to understand how housing costs might impact something like this, sort of think about the calculations that an average middle-class family would be making in San Francisco as their toddler approaches the age of five. The one thing they'll be deciding is, do we have enough room here in this apartment or in this condo with this growing child here? And many of them decide at that age, no, we need to get a bigger place to live. And that brings them head first into this terrible cost of housing there. So a lot of the families are deciding that, given some question about the school system's ability to educate and the incredible cost of housing in the city, they're going to head to the suburbs. And that seems to be the reason for this flight of children out of the school system.
Could it be, Otis, that it is simply a matter of demographics? In other words, could it be that now that the echo boom has matured somewhat, that, you know, there's simply a demographic dip as occurs on a regular basis, and that we have more schools than the population that needs to be served?
Well, that would normally be a really good explanation, and that works in a lot of places. It just doesn't work in San Francisco, where there are more toddlers now than there used to be. That is, more children under the age of five. It is at the age of five that you begin to see this disappearing demographic in San Francisco. So, no, it seems to be they got lots of babies and toddlers there. They just are losing their age five and above.
Well, San Francisco certainly is not the only city to be dealing with affordable housing, but it's probably where the problem is most acute.
It is the most dramatic place.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Paul Polizzotto is founder and CEO of EcoMedia, parent company of EcoZone. Prior to forming the company, Paul founded Property Prep, an industrial environmental cleaning company, where he pioneered a concept known as urban watershed cleaning and a process called zero discharge. For his work there, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency named Paul an environmental hero. He was also named a public-private visionary by Vanity Fair and received the Coastal Living 2003 Leadership Award. Paul, you just announced a program with Miami that named the city an ecozone. Tell me, what is an ecozone?
The ecozone program helps cities deal with the challenges of energy conservation, improving the condition of the rivers, lakes, and streams, enhancing green space, and dealing with air quality.
And how does it help them meet those challenges?
We help cities, counties, and states in three ways. We help provide comprehensive community outreach and education programs on television, radio, print, outdoor signage, internet, even experiential road shows that inspire and educate people to make two or three lifestyle changes so that they can be part of the solution themselves. Secondly, we provide critical funding for technologies and projects that help cities make measurable progress on the environment. We fund solar panels on the tops of public libraries and schools, public buildings. We fund hybrid and alternative fuel vehicles, electric vehicles, hybrid buses into city fleets. And we fund catch basin insert filters that go into storm drains that filter out trash and debris, oil and grease, contaminated sediments, and in some cases even pathogens from entering rivers and lakes and streams. So our goal is to provide funding to see measurable progress in these cities. Third, and just as importantly, we have developed an advisory board that includes the Department of Energy, EPA, NOAA, our corporate sponsors, and environmental groups to help identify the best available technologies and the most effective best management practices so that the money that we provide can be spent on projects and technologies that have the most measurable impact. What we find is that the cities that we're working with are the environmental departments or the public works departments really do care. I mean, without exception, I have found that the cities throughout this country have very talented and bright people who are committed to helping these cities comply with state and federal environmental mandates, but that oftentimes they're underfunded and understaffed, and what they really need is the necessary funding and some of the direction to make sure that the money is spent intelligently to have the biggest environmental impact. So we provide those three important components, which help cities comply with federal and state environmental mandates, but also, most importantly, make measurable progress in cleaning up our environment.
Paul, when you say we, who is we?
We is our program, the EcoZone program. Our company, the name of our company is EcoMedia, and our environmental program is the EcoZone program.
And where does the money to provide this critical funding for technology come from?
It comes from corporate sponsors. And we're really a coin. On one side of the coin, we're an environmental media company. And we help corporations accomplish reaching their consumer in a new way, in a way in which helps corporations change the quality of the consumer's life and the communities in which their consumers live. We also help corporations accomplish their government affairs, environmental affairs, community affairs, corporate social responsibility initiatives, marketing and advertising initiatives, all through one program, thereby giving corporations a very, very unique and compelling return on investment for their marketing and advertising dollars. So we're reaching their consumer through what are really mainstream media products, an hour television show syndicated quarterly, a web new media component where through webisodes and mobisodes we're reaching consumers and inspiring and educating citizens and consumers. In addition, we have a conference and lecture series which includes the Department of Energy and EPA and NOAA, corporate sponsors, environmental groups. And we also have an experiential roadshow that goes out to communities that raises awareness on environmental issues, but also is a direct opportunity for our corporate sponsors to reach consumers. We also produce 30 and 60-second what we call public service commercials, and we also have outdoor signage, unique outdoor signage, where 50% of the money from our outdoor signage goes directly to the cities to fund the environmental cleanup projects that I referred to earlier.
Paul, you say that your model is bringing corporate dollars to cities. What is the value of the corporate commitment to the city?
50% of the money that is raised goes directly to the city to fund environmental technologies and projects. Now, in addition to the 50%, the cities receive a comprehensive community outreach and education program for free that helps them comply with their federal and state environmental mandates. If you take the city of Miami, for example, 50% of the money from the outdoor signs produces $200,000 a year to fund technologies and projects. In addition to that, they receive a community outreach and education program that's worth $1.5 billion or more. So all in, it's a program that's worth $1.5 million and beyond.
Why do you think it is that cities don't have enough commitment to budget for these items?
Well, I think environmental projects are competing with other priorities that cities have. And I think if the focus was purely on the dollars and didn't also value the community outreach and education component, because one of the things I think we all need to take part in personally are the two or three lifestyle changes that all of us can make to take some of the burden off of these cities in cleaning up the environment. And so when you take the $200,000 in, let's say, Miami, and in bigger cities it's quite a bit more, but and combine it with the community outreach and education program, in Miami's case, that's $3 for every citizen in the city of Miami, and I think that's meaningful. That's $3 for every citizen in Miami for the environment that's not otherwise being paid for by the taxpayer.
Paul, when you talk about two or three lifestyle changes that EcoMedia is promoting and being promoted through the EcoZone, what are those lifestyle changes?
The lifestyle changes are pretty simple. They're not littering. Reduce, reuse, recycle. It's conserving energy, turning off lights that aren't necessary. It's ride sharing. It's using mass transit. There are so many things that all of us can do to make a contribution to cleaning up our environment. These things are not that difficult. And those are the kinds of things that we're trying to inspire among citizens. And that's how I think the real value of this program is far more significant than just the dollars that are coming from the outdoor signage, is that if we all do make those changes, the impact is really very significant.
When a city receives the EcoZone designation, as Miami has, what are the city's commitments?
The city's commitments, first and foremost, are to spend the funding that we provide exclusively for cleaning up the environment in Miami. And what we do is we help guide the city through our advisory board on the best available technologies, the most effective best management practices, so that we can have the most measurable impact on the environment. So whether that's solar energy projects on public buildings or introducing hybrid and alternative electric fuel vehicles, hybrid buses into city fleets, whether that's catch basin insert filters that go into storm drains that filter out various pollutants from entering rivers and lakes and streams, we identify those projects. We look at the most effective technologies and make those changes.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Paul Polizotto. He is founder and CEO of Eco Media, the parent company of EcoZone. Besides Miami, Paul, are there other cities that have signed on?
Yes, we actually kicked off the EcoZone program in Washington, D.C. last month, and Miami was the second city in the United States to launch the EcoZone program. Over the remaining part of the summer and early fall, we'll be launching out on the West Coast in many cities throughout Los Angeles. We'll be launching in Long Beach, California, in many cities in the South Bay area of Los Angeles, as well as San Francisco. We'll be launching in our program in cities throughout the Midwest in the late fall, and St. Petersburg, Florida, and throughout the Northeast. So this is a national program with a very local impact. We are currently either in or negotiating contracts in 15 of the top 25 cities in the United States.
And which companies are participating?
Companies like Daimler Chrysler, CH2M Hill, Hyatt Hotels, just a whole host of both large Fortune 500 corporations as well as local companies. And I think that's one of the neat things about this project, is that this is not a program that is exclusive just to large corporations, but to local corporations as well. What we're doing is offering large corporations an opportunity to accomplish their, you know, advertising and marketing objectives while at the same time improving the quality of their consumers' life and the environment and the communities that they do business in.
Do you vet participating companies in any way in terms of their commitment to running environmentally sound operations?
Yeah, we do have our own sort of internal discussions as a program as to companies that have sound internal sustainability initiatives going on in their companies. And we look for companies that have been doing these kinds of things in communities in one form or another as being the principal targets that we go out and want to do business with. And so what we find is most of the companies that we're going after are already doing both sustainability on an internal level, but are also have a history of doing things in communities. What we're trying to do is improve their return on investment by taking dollars that are ordinarily spent on marketing and advertising and giving those same dollars greater value by accomplishing their other business objectives, government affairs, environmental affairs, community affairs, corporate social responsibility initiatives. So the pattern I think that exists with the companies that we're dealing with is that they have a number of different business objectives. They have a number of different silos within their companies where they have a government affairs department, an environmental affairs department, community affairs, corporate social responsibility, marketing and advertising. And we're saying $1 spent with our program can have an impact across all of those different business objectives.
What do you expect to achieve with these messages? Obviously, you want behavior change, but what would be a good rate of return in terms of behavior change? Do you have a goal?
I can't say that we have an established goal, but what we are doing in these communities is we are measuring our impact. I'll give you an example. In Long Beach, California, we fund a mobile educational campaign through Windows on Our Waters and the Tide Pool Cruiser that goes out to schools in Long Beach. We give kids and families tests before they go through the display and test afterwards. So what we want to see is a shift in their awareness. It's a great opportunity to for kids to have an interactive experience in learning about the environment. In the case of Southern California, we're teaching kids the difference between storm drain systems and sewer systems, that in Southern California they have distinctly separate systems. And so what we're demonstrating to kids is that they throw something in the street, that it will ultimately find its way into Santa Monica Bay and the region's waterways, and that toilets and sinks and those kinds of things get treatment at Hyperion plants or treatment plants. And then they have a very tactile experience with marine life so that they can see the connection of their actions with marine life. And then ultimately we show them something called the Store of the Sea, where kids get to scan products. And what's neat about it is that the hardware is the same exact hardware that exists in the grocery store. So they bar scan toothpaste, and up comes on the screen that toothpaste uses seaweed or kelp. And it goes through a whole series of products that that kids wouldn't ordinarily connect with their oceans. And what we're trying to teach kids and families is that whether they're swimming or surfing in Santa Monica Bay on a daily basis or not, that their actions affect the products they use and the food they eat and the water they drink. And we test the folks afterwards, and we get to see a shift in their awareness. And our goal is to do the same kind of thing on energy conservation and on other environmental issues as we roll out our EcoZone program nationally.
Is that an example, Paul, of what you referred to earlier as your experiential roadshow?
Yes, although that's a small example of something that we're doing in Southern California. What we'll be launching in the spring of 2007, right around Earth Day, we'll be launching a national campaign through our EcoZone program that, as I said earlier, will include an hour television show syndicated quarterly, a conference lecture series, a whole web component through webisodes and mobisodes, and our experiential roadshow. And that roadshow will be a great opportunity to educate and inspire citizens on the kinds of things that they can do to have an impact on cleaning up our environment. And we'll have a rock climbing wall. We'll be working with the Department of Energy and EPA and NOAA to have touch screens that inspire folks to learn more about the environment. So there's a whole series of different things in our roadshow that make learning fun. It's a 45-minute experience that is very enjoyable but also very educational.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you've mentioned it three times, so I'm going to have to ask you, what is a mobisode?
It's content that's created for mobile phones and PDAs, and our goal is to leverage the power of new media to reach consumers on their own terms and to reach them through the medium that they're now receiving information. This is a really interesting and an exciting time in media that, you know, the consumer has lots and lots of options on how they want to receive information and content and entertainment. And we need to be just as agile in our educational information as media is in reaching them with entertaining content.
Before founding EcoMedia, you were founder and CEO of Property Prep, an industrial environmental cleaning company. Describe the work you did there.
Property Prep, which was my first enterprise, my goal was to create methods for cleaning storm drain systems, industrial sites, parking lots, removing pollutants that would otherwise end up in Santa Monica Bay during a rain event. The way that worked is that we would clean surfaces and capture all of the detergents that we use to clean parking lots and industrial sites and storm drain systems, and bring it back to our facility, treat it to an effluent profile that was acceptable to LA County Sanitation, LA County Public Works, and ultimately keep it from entering Santa Monica Bay. And through doing that, really created something called urban watershed cleaning, a process called zero discharge, where we created an environmentally compliant alternative. What was happening prior to the creation of property prep and prior to the creation of those methods is that cleaning contractors would clean parking lots and manufacturing facilities and just wash all of the pollutants and detergents into the storm drain system, which would ultimately end up in Santa Monica Bay untreated. And I saw an opportunity to legitimize an industry, the contract cleaning industry, and come up with a way of removing pollutants from surfaces that would ordinarily go into the bay untreated during a rain event.
Was it that experience that propelled you into forming EcoMedia?
Well, I think the original inspiration for creating EcoMedia started as a very young man growing up in Manhattan Beach, California, where, much to my parents' chagrin, I spent far too much time surfing. And when I saw what was going on in Santa Monica Bay, it really gave me the goal of helping to be part of the solution, helping to clean up Santa Monica Bay. Here we were involved in this very healthy lifestyle, surfing, and I was sick all the time. My friends were sick all the time. And from that experience, I decided I wanted to spend my career helping to clean up the environment. And through that, saw what was going on in Southern California with these contract cleaners that were cleaning things in an illegal way and washing it all down into the storm drains. And I said, there's a chance to remove pollutants from surfaces in an environmentally compliant way and make an impact. And through being immersed in the whole stormwater and urban runoff situation in Southern California, I saw an opportunity to help cities comply with new, more stringent stormwater laws, urban runoff laws, through the creation of my Adopt a Waterway program. And by launching Adopt a Waterway in Southern California, watching it grow throughout the nation into 14 cities nationwide, I saw that the public-private partnership that we created through Adopt a Waterway was working, and therefore saw the chance to broaden it into air and energy, parks and green space, and water, giving cities an opportunity to look at the environment more comprehensively and integrating all of the environmental challenges into one program. And then from there, really saw the opportunity to grow it into a media company. And that's where I created EcoMedia.
Project out 5 years, Paul. What is it you hope to have accomplished with EcoMedia?
I hope to demonstrate that corporations can reach consumers and at the same time reach consumers in a new way, in a compelling way, but at the same time change the quality of the consumer's life and the communities where they do business and where their employees and consumers live to clean up the environment. In addition to that, I see the program, EcoZone, the EcoZone program, as an opportunity to help cities that are dealing with the challenges of air and energy conservation, parks and green space and water, and to make a measurable impact and leave behind a legacy that this type of innovation can really lead to measurable progress.
Paul, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Polizzotto is founder and CEO of EcoMedia. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. An online search for the term how to be successful yields some 883 million related links to fame and fortune. Add the word generosity to the search, and that number drops by more than 90%. CityViews commentator Walker Smith says that the secret to leading a healthy, more fulfilling life might be hidden in that one word.
Greed has become an ingrained, even exalted element of our contemporary moral calculus. We celebrate it in movie characters like Gordon Gekko, who proclaimed in the movie Wall Street that, quote-unquote, greed is good. We presume that every behavior is nothing but the manifestation of an underlying drive to maximize self-interest. We hold it to be an end in itself, a fundamental motive force that can excuse even the worst excesses of selfishness and egotism. But in doing so, perhaps we have overlooked our own self-interest. A long-term study of couples over 65 completed at the University of Michigan found that those who describe themselves as providing emotional support or actual help to others were 50% less likely to die. This was in contrast to those receiving the support or help who were no less likely to die. The people who benefited from support and help were those giving it, not those receiving it. These researchers noted that their findings parallel those of many other studies showing that social contacts and interpersonal networks are correlated with higher survival rates. Giving, not receiving, appears to be the best way to get the benefits of social connections. These researchers further speculated that perhaps the best way to help others is not to do something for them, but to encourage them to do something for others. Perhaps giving is beneficial because, contrary to popular belief, we are actually wired more for giving than for getting. Researchers at Emory University found in a study of game-playing strategies that cooperative strategies stimulated the pleasure centers of the brain, not so for uncooperative strategies. Interestingly, when test subjects competed against a computer instead of against one another, cooperative strategies did not generate the same level of brain stimulation. Apparently, cooperative strategies are stimulating because they create a human bond, and it is that personal connection that is pleasurable. Selflessness, not selfishness, gets us what we want. The second richest man in the world certainly seems to think so. Warren Buffett is turning his fortune over to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Not to use his charity to build a monument to himself, but to give his support to causes that are bigger than himself. Buffett said at the time of his announcement that he agreed with legendary financier Andrew Mellon that great fortunes due in large part to the advantages and opportunities created by society should in large part be returned to society. By this view, greed takes a backseat to generosity. Indeed, as Buffett also noted, his children have grown up with all the advantages that his wealth could provide and are doing well. So flooding them with money will help them no more. Time now to get more by giving. This is the sort of aspiration we should all consider, the charity that connects us to community, not the veneration of selfishness and greed, is the real secret to success and the true elixir of life, longevity, and a lasting impact. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive is supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.